It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the governor's budget includes a boost for mental health crisis intervention. We'll find out why a lot of Wisconsin has limited access to emergency treatment. First, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says he won't support a commission to investigate the January 6th insurrection. That's a blow for a group of lawmakers who want a bipartisan investigation like the one that looked into the 9/11 attacks. We're talking about that and more in our weekly look at the top stories in Washington. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a special commission investigate what happened at the nation's capital on January 6th? What questions do you have about that day that you think an investigation could answer? Do you want to see bipartisan agreement on what that commission could look like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andy Duren covers Congress and American politics for the Wall Street Journal. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Before we get into the statement from Senate Minority Leader McConnell today, can you let us know where we are on legislation that would create this commission?
So at the beginning of this week, there was actually a bipartisan agreement between the top lawmakers on the House Homeland Security Committee. The top Republican and the top Democrat said they had reached a deal to form a commission, a bipartisan commission, to study the attacks or the events of January 6th. And so this was something that had been in negotiations for quite some time, and that there had been some back and forth on. And Democrats said that they had kind of accommodated some of the Republican requests, and so there was finally this agreement. But then not long after that, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said that he would not support the agreement. And then earlier today, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, the top Republican in the Senate, said that he would not also would be opposed to this commission. So that said, there will still be a vote on this, on creating this commission later today in the House. And it is actually expected to garner a fair amount of Republican support. There are a number of Republicans who, actually voted to impeach Donald Trump over the events of January 6th. And then there are, other Republicans who do want to see a more thorough investigation and an investigation conducted by people who are not members of Congress into those events. So, the statement that McConnell made this morning was kind of the latest turn of the screw, but then there will be the vote today to actually create that commission in the House, and then it will go from there to the Senate.
Yeah, let's listen to Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader here, talking earlier today on the Senate floor.
It's not at all clear what new facts or additional investigation yet another commission could actually lay on top of existing efforts by law enforcement and Congress. The facts have come out, and they'll continue to come out.
McConnell there referring to, I think, some congressional committee investigations. Why are, for example, Democrats and, as you mentioned, some Republicans hopeful that this will be done by people not currently in Congress, something like the 9/11 commission?
So I think there are a couple of reasons. I think one is there is maybe the, added authority of having a commission that is structured in a bipartisan way and that is not conducted by members of Congress themselves. It kind of washes away some of the concerns about partisanship, that, their accusations of partisanship and how the investigation is conducted and what the investigation maybe concludes. I think another element of it, too, and something that some of the Republicans who support the commission have brought up, is that there are certain, elements of the events of January 6th that it would be easier for a commission like this that kind of has an overall mandate to investigate all the various events of the day to investigate. So something, an example of that is something like, the contacts that, then President Trump had with members of Congress during the attack and on the day of the attack, and, basically giving the commission the ability to subpoena other members of Congress, including someone like House, like Kevin McCarthy, to compel them to talk about, what the contents of their conversations with Donald Trump were on that day and things like that. And so that is something, information like that is actually something that is seen as being pretty difficult to ascertain through kind of the existing congressional investigative structure and framework. And so folks are, you know, that is an example, I guess, of the type of information that folks see as something that they could maybe possibly get through this other commission.
Talking to Andy Duren from the Wall Street Journal, looking at some of the top stories in national news, including right now the idea of creating this commission to look at the events of January 6th. You can join in with your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Gwen is with us in Madison. Gwen, hi. Are you there, Gwen?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Gwen. You're on the air now.
Okay. I very strongly believe that we need a January 6th commission similar to the 9/11 commission. And I would like to see it be bipartisan, but I don't want anyone on the commission who is not committed to an honest, full investigation that is not conducted in a way that, you know, has political leanings. I want it to be a fair, impartial evaluation.
Gwen, we're losing you a little bit, but I take your point. Thanks for that call. Andy, what do we know about this current plan as it stands about who would be on this commission, who gets to pick who would be on this commission?
So the membership of the commission was actually one of the sticking points in some of the negotiations. At first, there was, because, you know, Democrats currently control both the House and the Senate, the original proposal would have given them, you know, Democrats the selection of the majority of the members of the commission. But one of the kind of revisions that was agreed to was that there would be an even split in terms of, you know, the membership of the commission and, you know, requiring that the chair and the vice chair, you know, agree on subpoena requests and all sorts of things like that to try and level out, I guess, you know, the influence that the Democratic leaders in Congress and the Republican leaders in Congress would have over its structure and its membership. In terms of, you know, who, you know, individuals who would serve on the commission, I think that's something that is still preliminary. I think, you know, given the steep path for even creating this commission in the first place, I don't know that there's, you know, specific ideas or specific people at this point that are going to be named, but I'm sure there are probably lots of people who would be interested in serving on a commission like that.
Can you talk about some of the politics behind this? We had, you know, soon after January 6th, some Republicans critical of the president and of the insurrection itself. Minority Leader McConnell said after voting for impeachment or against impeachment, excuse me, in February, he said former President Trump was practically and morally responsible for the attack. Now it seems like some Republicans have even said explicitly, we don't want to be focusing back on the past now. We want to look ahead to midterm elections. This would just get in the way. Can you talk about the politics behind this a little bit?
Yeah, certainly. So, of course, you know, hanging over all of this is just the enormous difficulty that Republicans have had in both the House and the Senate dealing with the aftermath of the January 6th attack and of, you know, President Trump's continued or former President Trump's continued influence over the party and his continued demands for, you know, how Republican lawmakers should approach these issues and behave on and talk about these issues. And so, you know, obviously we just went through, you know, among House Republicans, there was just, you know, just last week, the ouster of Liz Cheney, who was formerly the number three, you know, one of the top members of the House Republican Conference. She was removed, voted out of her position because she did vote to impeach Trump after January 6th. And then also since then, she has been very consistent about, you know, pointing out, you know, the lies basically at the root of some of Trump's claims about what happened on January 6th and in the 2020 election. And so, you know, there have just been, you know, these continued conflagrations among Republicans over these events and what to do about Trump. And this is just, to your point, another instance where you have, you know, you do have a minority of Republicans who do, you know, they see January 6th as a very dangerous, you know, attack on American democracy and a very dangerous kind of instance in American history. And they want to take, you know, a number of steps to kind of, you know, remove and excise as much as they can of what they see as the dangers there. And then you have a large set of Republicans who are still, you know, still see Donald Trump as an important, you know, motivator in Republican politics, an important draw for a lot of people to the Republican Party. And so they feel that they need to be loyal to him. And it doesn't, you know, it also makes a difference that Donald Trump continues to kind of put out statements and, you know, very vocally weigh in on a lot of these issues. And so it creates a lot of headaches for folks in terms of a lot of, you know, political headaches for Republicans in terms of figuring how to deal with all of this. And so, yeah, to your point, I think there is, an element of creating this commission, you know, which is something that, you know, Donald Trump has said he opposes, is something that maybe Republicans don't want to vote to do, because it just adds to, you know, just creates more internal difficulties for them.
Talking to Andy Duren with The Wall Street Journal. We're talking about some of the top stories in Washington this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we'll take more of your calls on the idea of a January 6th commission, and we'll get into infrastructure a little bit. Evergreen topic on this weekly segment. Do you want to see Congress pass something relating to infrastructure? If so, what? Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at the top stories in Washington with Andy Duren from The Wall Street Journal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. In a few minutes, we'll get into the latest on efforts to pass something, anything on infrastructure. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Still taking your calls right now on the idea of a January 6th commission. We'll go back to your calls. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. If we talk about the infrastructure, I must say I'm amazed that the progressives have allowed the continuation of the SALT tax. I got to praise them for that. Praise them for continuing to limit the deduction of the SALT tax. But the real thing that I found interesting about the commission is, how can anyone think that the commission would be unbiased and unpolitical when we just have the Russiagate, where the dossier turns out to be nothing more than Clinton campaign fodder? I mean, this is all political. This is nothing but going to continue to cause division within the country. And can't we just move on from Donald Trump and all the other stuff and get to back to just talking about policy?
Charlie, thanks for the call. The Rush investigation, the Trump White House, his attorney general appointed a Republican, Robert Mueller, to try to assuage concerns, I think, about partisanship. Andy, could something similar happen there? Is there a formula, do you think, to find a panel that people would view as reliable?
You know, I do think it certainly would depend on who was, you know, eventually or possibly selected to run a commission like this. To your point, I think, you know, at the time, Robert Mueller was, when he was selected, was seen as someone who would be kind of beyond or above partisan politics, given his background as a, you know, a lifelong Republican and someone who served in the government and was a respected law enforcement official for his whole career. But to the other point about, you know, folks wanting to move on and talk about policy, I do think that is a perspective that a lot of Republicans share when it comes to January 6th and even just, the topic of Donald Trump in general in the 2020 election and the various kind of conversations around that. I mean, I do think that there have been these halting efforts by Republicans to try and focus on elements of President Biden's agenda that they see as, you know, politically advantageous to them, whether that's something like immigration or whether that's, the president's proposed tax increases on corporations and high income households in the United States. Those are topics where Republicans think, you know, this is good politics for us if we can get out in front of, you know, television cameras and reporters and talk about, you know, these issues and kind of have stories about Republicans be focused on, you know, what we think about corporate tax rates or even the SALT deduction or all number of issues. That would be, you know, far better for, in terms of kind of bolstering popular Republican support than kind of going through, you know, these various ins and outs of the events of January 6th and the 2020 election and having to just constantly, you know, navigate their relationship with President Trump, who, you know, while he, you know, not only did he, you know, lose the 2020 election, but then, you know, Republicans lost control of both the House and the Senate, you know, while he was in office. So there is a desire among Republicans to focus more on the Biden agenda and opposing it.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. Let's bring on one more call before we move on to infrastructure issues. Paul is with us in Richland Center. Paul, hi.
Hey, thanks, Rob. I just want to speak to Republican voters at both the local level, the state level, and the national level. The difference between the 9/11 commission and what's going to happen with this January 6th commission is that the 9/11 commission had bipartisan support because the people that did the attacking were of people of a different skin color. And the January 6th were white folk that supported Trump, their supreme leader. And I am so sick of people just voting Republican, and we need to stop this. We need to make sure that we understand who we're voting for. There are plenty of Democratic local, state, and federal people that are running, but they're not getting votes. And I am just really tired of it.
Paul, thanks for the call. As we wrap up on this, Andy, do you see that as driving, or maybe just the partisan makeup of the Washington, D.C. January 6th events as being fundamentally different from those 9/11 attacks, and as our caller said, making it harder to get agreement from Republicans?
Oh, I think, of course, that is a part of all of this. Not only is not only did many Republicans in Congress, did they vote not to certify Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 election on January 6th, which was kind of the subject of a lot of these of the attack on January 6th. But then they also are this idea that the election was stolen in November 2020, and that Donald Trump did win that is something that is an idea that has some pull among Republican voters across the country, and so that is something that a lot of Republicans on January 6th and since then, they feel somewhat beholden to at least entertaining that idea and the some of the legitimacy of some of these claims because of the politics of it and the fact that people whose vote they want do believe these things, and so they vote for a commission that undercuts those ideas or challenges those ideas presents just political challenges for them.
Talking to Andy Duren. He covers Congress and American politics for the Wall Street Journal, looking at some of the top stories in national news. Let's move finally to infrastructure. Andy, you've been following this. What kind of conversations are going on in Congress right now as, at least in theory, people are trying to negotiate some kind of infrastructure spending bill?
Yeah, so the main conversations happening right now is they're between the White House, a group of, administration officials and a group of Senate Republicans who have kind of put out their own counter proposal to the White House's $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan. So there were some meetings last week where this group of Republicans, they were up at the White House meeting with President Biden in the Oval Office. And then actually just yesterday, a few of these administration officials, including folks like Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, we're actually on Capitol Hill meeting with the Republicans there. So far, there have been a few of these conversations. And even before that, there have been a lot of kind of, contacts with bipartisan groups of lawmakers on Capitol Hill in the White House. There are still a lot of fundamental issues that are, not resolved at this point, including primarily, even how much money should be spent on infrastructure. This group of Senate Republicans has proposed a $568 billion plan over 5 years. The Biden plan is obviously much larger than that. And then, so they're still, quite far apart on just, what to spend. And then there's the possibly even more difficult question of, this question of financing it and how to pay for it. So Biden administration has proposed, a series of tax increases on corporations to pay for the infrastructure part of their agenda. And then the Senate Republicans have kind of offered a series or talked about a series of user fees or using existing federal funds. And so though there has not been, much, I guess you could say, visible progress on some of those, fundamental issues in the talk so far, the latest kind of development is that, the White House indicated after yesterday's meeting that they expect to kind of respond to the Republicans in a little bit more of a formal way by the end of this week. And so we'll see what happens there. But to your point, there are a lot of, major differences between Republicans and Democrats on this issue. And then there is also just the fact that Democrats do have the ability to move forward with infrastructure spending without Republican support if they want to. So that's just another part of this where, you know, that will limit the number of concessions that Democrats want to make when they do have the power ultimately to do a fair amount of what they want to be able to do along party lines.
Is there any sense that we're near, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel here? Because on this segment, we've had a category of latest conversations about infrastructure. I don't know, going back well into the Trump administration, like, sure. Does it seem like anything's actually moving?
You know, I do think there are. So obviously, there are all these differences. There are some. The main reason to still believe that there could be a deal here is that Congress has a statutory requirement to reauthorize federal infrastructure and transportation programs every few years. And so Congress currently faces a deadline of September 30th to reauthorize a whole bunch of different infrastructure programs that already exist. And usually when these reauthorization opportunities come up, Congress will also add new programs, increase funding, make changes to the existing programs and things like that. And so that does have to happen by the end of September. And because of kind of the various wonky budget rules, it seems like that is something that would have to basically happen with bipartisan support, especially in the Senate. And so there is that. That is kind of, I think, keeping people at the table, just this idea that there does need to be something that happens on some forms of infrastructure by the end of the federal fiscal year. And that probably has to be bipartisan. And even if that is ultimately, you know, much narrower than the Biden plan, maybe that's worth kind of taking that and running with it and, you know, crossing that to-do item off the list, so to speak. And, you know, President Biden has, you know, talked about this both publicly and in meetings with Republicans, saying, you know, I will maybe look at a narrower infrastructure bill, something, you know, much smaller than what I've proposed, and do that on a bipartisan basis first, and then move on to a broader, you know, more ambitious bill that I do, you know, just with other Democrats. But these are all still very much in kind of the theoretical phase in terms of there haven't been any, you know, major decisions made. The White House has not said anything super conclusive about what they think about what Senate Republicans are proposing. And so, you know, we are looking for more kind of concrete signals of where things are headed here and what decisions might actually be made about, you know, the various questions on infrastructure.
Andy, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Andy Duren. He covers Congress and American politics for The Wall Street Journal. He was with us today for our weekly look at some of the top news in national politics. Coming up after news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, we'll look at proposals in the governor's budget aimed at boosting mental health care in the state. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, the pandemic has had a big impact on the labor market, putting people out of work at first, now raising questions about a possible labor shortage as the economy opens up more and more. A labor expert joins the show tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, even before Wisconsin felt the full effects of the COVID-19 pandemic last year, the state's historians and curators were considering how they should document its impact. Then came a summer of historic protests. Megan Hart has more on how future generations might remember 2020.
Last June, Hannah Beauchamp Pope led a Black Lives Matter march through the streets of downtown Green Bay. Almost a year later, she revisited part of the route.
I think we started going up over this bridge here, and it was just like when you fall into like line with everybody and you like turn around and you see like the mass of people behind you. And just the fact that we all moved as one community, it was just kind of, it gives you goosebumps.
Just over that bridge is the Neville Public Museum. While activists like Beauchamp Pope were aiming to change the world, and scientists and healthcare professionals were working to save lives during the pandemic, curators and historians were acting to preserve our collective memories from a year we'll never forget. Last year, the museum put out a call for artifacts from the marches, and now some items from Beauchamp Pope are in its archives. The UW-Green Bay student submitted a poster with a Jimi Hendrix quote.
When the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace.
The new Nike sneakers Beauchamp Pope wore to the march are also now part of the Neville's collection. Executive Director Beth Lemke talked about some of the items in the museum's cavernous storage area.
These are all things that are in process. And so in this case, from Hannah, we have her T-shirt, we have a scarf and a bracelet that she wore during that march. We also took in a megaphone that was used to help, talk to the crowd as they were standing there.
Curator Lisa Kane says the Neville's collection should represent the people living in Green Bay today. She pointed out one of the posters.
This one is pretty plain. It's small, but it says Black Lives Matter in Hmong.
Museum officials say they're always contemporary collecting. But Estella Chung, chief curator of the Wisconsin Historical Society, says it's rare for two watershed moments to overlap as they did with the pandemic and the protests. She says curators had to be very thoughtful about the moments they want to preserve for future generations.
And to pay attention to all the different stories and voices and perspectives all happening at once. So this was our big challenge during the year 2020.
The pandemic changed daily life for pretty much everyone, and Chung says it's unusual for curators to work with items related to events that impacted their own lives. The Society is still adding to its pandemic collection, which already includes makeshift masks and plexiglass dividers. It's also documenting daily life during the pandemic with the COVID-19 Journal Project. Director Christian Overland says thousands of people reached out to say they'll be submitting journals. Some are somber, remembering the traditions we had to abandon during the pandemic, while others cover more quotidian aspects of pandemic life.
There was one great journal that came out of the Eau Claire region. The people actually just put every receipt that they had in it for like 9 months and kind of what they bought and what they ate. Bird watchers keeping journals. We have art journals.
The Society has long used journals to document history. It has one from the Lewis and Clark expedition, some from the very first class of Peace Corps volunteers, and many from the Civil War.
We actually sent out 600 journals with soldiers and pencils with them that were marshaled out of Camp Randall in Madison. And over 400 of those journals came back.
The journal project is ongoing, as of course the pandemic isn't over yet. And back in Green Bay, Beauchamp Pope says her work for social justice has just begun. But there's still value in having her activism documented for future museum goers.
I know that like some little black girl is going to go to that and they're going to see another black woman.
And they'll know they can make history too. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, Governor Evers' budget includes policies to improve mental health care in Wisconsin. Under the governor's plan, Medicaid would be expanded to include overnight stays at mental health care facilities, and crisis intervention centers would be set up around Wisconsin, growing the number of state-run psychiatric facilities from the current 2. We're talking now about access to mental health care and crisis intervention in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been a part of your life or a loved one for you where they needed some kind of mental health crisis intervention and didn't have access to it nearby? Or do you work in law enforcement where you've had to maybe drive people hours from one place to another so they can get this kind of crisis intervention? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Shemaine Mills is WPR's health reporter. She's been following this story. Shemaine, welcome back.
Hi. Thanks, Rob.
Well, you shared a story of someone from Superior that really illustrates the problem of the limited number of these crisis care facilities. Can you share that story with us, Shemaine?
Yeah. This woman had very distressing personal experience where she would have mental health episodes. Police would be called. She was hospitalized 33 times for reckless driving, suicide attempts. She said she had uncontrollable shopping sprees where she dropped $1,400 at one incident. So she was picked up by police, and she was taken 5 hours away to Winnebago. She was from Superior. They transported her to Winnebago. It was the nearest place they had available psychiatric care at the level she needed. And she described it as being terrifying, as she was handcuffed because police didn't know if she was a danger to herself or others. It was a long car ride. She was already traumatized. So it was a difficult experience on what was later a successful road to recovery.
And the governor's budget aims to create regional crisis intervention facilities, I guess, to add alternatives, closer alternatives to the two we have in the state. Can you talk about that plan?
Yeah, right now people are either taken to Mendota Mental Health in Madison or Winnebago Mental Health Institute. And that particular facility has just seen an influx of patients from northern Wisconsin. I mean, there's more demand than there is supply. And moreover, it's not where people need it. It's not close by. People say they want to be near friends and family at this time. It's particularly important. So the governor is proposing these regional stabilization facilities that would be closer to where people need services.
And the other part of the governor's budget proposal that relates here is the idea of expanding Medicaid coverage to include an overnight stay in this kind of facility. Medicaid covers residential care, as I understand it, but not the overnight stays. Is this getting support from Republicans so far?
Well, they haven't taken up this particular aspect of the governor's budget yet, but so we don't know for sure, but there has been some acceptance of providing money for mental health services from the GOP. For instance, they approved a 50-bed expansion at Mendota Mental Health for crisis care. So there could be some movement on this issue. It all depends how they're going to pay for it, though, of course. The governor would like to see federal Medicaid dollars to pay for this, and the GOP would rather see other dollars. So it's not a matter of just whether they'll say yes, it's how they're going to pay for it.
And Shemaine, before I let you go, the things we've been talking about so far are acute care, basically. There's a crisis and somebody needs this care now. Is there anything in the budget that has to do with a longer term access to mental health treatment?
Yeah, we've talked a lot about the immediate crisis care, but there's a number of things in the governor's budget, such as suicide hotlines and peer counseling, a number of things that would help people who've had just a really tough year because of the pandemic and the economy.
Shemaine, thanks for joining us again.
You bet. Thanks, Rob.
That's WPR health reporter Shemaine Mills. Ronald Diamond joins us now for more on mental health care in Wisconsin. He's a consultant to the Wisconsin Bureau of Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery. He's also a professor emeritus of psychiatry at UW-Madison and former medical director of the Mental Health Center of Dane County. Ron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
What do you see as the most critical gap or maybe gaps in Wisconsin's mental health system?
Well, there are lots of different gaps. It's kind of unfortunate because at one point Wisconsin was the national leader in how to do this, and we put a lot of the ideas together. Certainly the idea of regional crisis centers makes a lot of sense as a beginning place, and I support that part of the bill. In addition to that, you need to have something that will help people both before and after the crisis to decrease the need for number of crises, to provide follow-up, to prevent the next crisis. This is really more than just the peer support and the suicide hotlines, which I also support. There needs to be provision for ongoing services that will, in fact, help people stabilize their lives. The reality is this not only helps the patients involved, it tremendously helps the families who often don't know what to do, the communities around them who are seeing aberrant behavior and not knowing how to respond to it, and it also helps the police. When we were doing this more actively in Dane County, the police were our biggest champions because it allows them to get out of a business they don't want and get back into a business they do want. And the close partnership between the mental health system and these crisis centers and the police really allows each side to do the job that they're designed to do.
Yeah, this acute crisis care center that we're talking about here, that seems like it's a last resort and kind of everything already has had to fail to get there. What kind of specific services would you say we need so that we don't have to end up there?
Well, rather than calling it a last resort, I'd call it one nodule in a continuum of care that some people may need to access at certain points of time, but it works best when the whole continuum is wrapped around. This might mean services that are available to low-income people or to kids, which are woefully inadequate around the state. It might mean teams of people that can help people with more psychotic or serious illnesses stabilize their lives, that do case management, that find housing. When we've in fact studied this both in Wisconsin and around the country, we find that you can set up teams, you can help people stabilize their lives, you can improve the quality of their lives for not any more money than we're currently spending. We're just spending it in very different ways.
We're talking to Ron Diamond, consultant to the Wisconsin Bureau of Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery, emeritus professor of psychiatry at UW-Madison, looking at mental health access in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you needed mental health care but had trouble finding affordable options or options available within, say, a three-hour drive of your community? Have you or a loved one had a mental health crisis and had to go far for treatment? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now about mental health care in Wisconsin. Ron Diamond stays with us, consultant of the Wisconsin Bureau of Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery, professor emeritus of psychiatry at UW-Madison. You could join in with your questions, your thoughts, and maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Chaz is with us in Madison. Chaz, hi.
Hi. Yeah, so I recently saw a psychologist, and then I haven't seen one since probably the last 2019. But then when I tried to seek psychiatric help from the same facility, I was no longer insured and found out that they no longer, you know, they didn't have any spaces available. And I asked, you know, profusely if you would give me any other places for options, and all the other places said that they would not take, you know, Medicare, or they're uninsured. So it just feels like very defeating right off the bat when you're calling to get help and every place that you call is just impossible to get through.
Chaz, thank you so much for calling. Sorry to hear that, and I hope you're able to find something out there. Ron, for somebody in Chaz's position, uninsured, not finding any options out there, what kind of things do we have anything in Wisconsin to help out?
Well, this is just a huge and major issue. It's actually better in Dane County and Milwaukee County than most places in the state. And as Chaz was saying, even in Dane County, the system really fails people. In rural areas of the state, it is much, much worse. Part of it is that there are just not resources out there. Part of it is that people can't afford the resources that are out there. One problem with it is that we're asking a system that's underfunded to provide indigent care or free care when nobody has the money to afford it. To some extent, the whole idea of fee-for-service mental health care is like asking to fund a fire department or a police department. When you need it, I'll pay for it. But when I don't need it, I don't want to pay to have the provision, the availability of it out there. I think that we need to have enough of a robust system out there that when people really need it, they can avail themselves. And I think we have to have a funding mechanism through the counties or through Medicaid or through something that makes it available. If not, people who are really in need are not going to go away. They're going to be brought to attention in some other way. We were talking about the lack of availability of beds. Well, around the state, we have 24/7 availability of local beds for people whose behavior is really off the wall, and it's called jail. And a lot of times we end up putting people in jail not because the police want to or the sheriffs want to or the jails want to, but because there are really no other options. And of all the cruddy, terrible options, that's the one that's most available. So we need to make services available that prevent people from going to jail, that prevent people from needing the hospital, that keep people in the community with a reasonable quality of life so they can have their apartment or their housing or their relationships or their job. And we're not doing that. It's just not there.
Chaz, thanks again for sharing your story, and best to you. Let's go to Helen now in Southeast Wisconsin. Helen, hello.
Hi, yeah, I guess for us, our family, this topic is so incredibly timely. We have a teenage daughter who is above the age of consent of 14, and she has been really depressed for months, and she's had multiple suicide attempts in the past month and a half. And part of our frustration is that her first time inpatient from a suicide attempt. She was sent home with medication and no follow-up plan in place. I think the expectation was that she would go to a day treatment, but because our daughter is not voluntary, we couldn't get any of the day treatment places to take her or put her on her waiting list. Due to that age of consent, you have to be voluntary. And our daughter is older than that. That was our frustration. So, of course, our daughter has had more suicide attempts since then, and she is currently back in another emergency detention inpatient, and they're talking again, sending her home on medications. And I'm frustrated because if they don't help us get to that next level of care, I don't know how we can do it if our daughter's not voluntary, and I fear she'll be dead by the end of the month.
That's heartbreaking, Helen. I'm so sorry to hear that. Ron, any thoughts?
Well, I think this is really an example of the whole breakdown of the system, and that sending somebody who's more severely distressed home with just a package of pills is just not enough to do it. There are lots of ways clinically to work with people who don't want to work with us. I've written chapters about this kind of thing. But you need to have the trained resources and the teams who will take this young woman where she is and try and entice her into care and provide a stable presence. And there are ways to do it with a voluntary patient without needing an emergency detention. There are also ways of starting with an emergency detention and continuing that into the community so the person gets a head start and they find that treatment is, in fact, making their life better. But both of these are labor-intensive operations of trained people, and we've not invested to make those resources available, not even in Dane County and certainly not in other parts of the state.
Helen, thanks, and best to you and your family and your daughter. Time for another caller. Alex is with us in Milwaukee. Alex, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a mental health provider in the greater Metro Milwaukee area. Work at a hospital in a day treatment program, and just wanted to just reinforce as well that the need for care is significant, especially for the population who can only be on Medicaid and Medicare. We're one of the only hospital systems that takes straight Title 19 or Title 18, and you know the need is significant, and I think you know the COVID crisis has definitely increased that need.
Alex, thanks for the call. Ron, so people on, even if they have Medicaid and Medicare coverage, they might not be able to find someone who takes it. Is that a common story?
Absolutely. And the reimbursement rates for Medicaid are so low that, for the most part, people, providers, systems can't afford to provide care at that level. Counties can't afford to provide care at that level, even if they capture the Medicaid dollars. Having said that, the availability of Medicaid dollars helps a lot. It's certainly low and it's not enough, but it's better than the $0 that we often deal with for people that don't even have Medicaid.
Thanks again for that call, Ron. In just our last minute or so, I don't know, from what you're hearing from the governor, from what you see from state lawmakers and maybe local officials, do you see an appetite to try to turn things around on the things we've been talking about?
I see an appetite on the part of some legislatures in some part of the state. And other people would try and hide their head in the sand and pretend that these people and these problems are going to go away. I'm not sure that there's a consensus around the state on the part of both sides of the aisle to really do what we need to do to address the issues involved. I will say that the people that we're talking about are not going to go away. They're going to be with us, and they're going to be causing problems for themselves, for their families, for the rest of us, for police, for society. And we can either choose to deal with them appropriately, well, humanely, with a good quality of life, or we can spend the same community resources and do pretty much what we've been doing for a long time, which is letting people go until they completely sink into the morass and then try and pick up the pieces of the crisis. I would hope that there's more of a consensus for dealing with this proactively and thoughtfully. I'm not sure that that's true in all parts of our state government.
Ron, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Ronald Diamond, consultant at the Wisconsin Bureau of Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery, also professor emeritus of psychiatry at UW-Madison. Join us for a look at mental health at care access in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, masks are coming off, and so are mask mandates, as some of the state's biggest cities and counties have set expiration dates for mask laws. A public health expert weighs in on those decisions and tells us who should still keep a mask handy. That and more, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It just occurred to me, I never told you what I did over the weekend. And I know you've been wondering. Well, great news, I managed to get out and enjoy not one, but two state parks over the course of the weekend. On Sunday, I did a bunch of hiking in Governor Dodge State Park, including a stop at a waterfall and a good stretch of hiking along the stream. Always happy to walk alongside a stream. And we stopped for a picnic lunch overlooking the lake. Plus, there was a concession stand with ice cream cones at a reasonable price. I'm never going to turn that down. Saturday was Blue Mound State Park. It was a misty day, which actually made for some pretty cool views, especially up in one of the towers. Picnic lunch in the parking lot picnic area. No ice cream available. It was still a good outing. But I got a little confused. I never remember if it's called Blue Mound State Park or Blue Mounds State Park. So I used my careful eye for detail that comes with being a professional journalist. And I learned that the park is called Blue Mound State Park, but the town right there is called Blue Mounds. Why? I don't know. Not yet, anyway. But in searching, I learned that Minnesota has a state park in the southwestern part of their state called Blue Mound State Park. Plus, I spent some time in Mount Horeb, saw some great food from a couple different restaurants, and ate said food. Plus, I saw some trolls. All in all, a perfect weekend. This is Central Time.